Chapter 58. Perverts. The baby-faced, pink-cheeked youth who drove along a quiet road near Coatesville, Pennsylvania, did not look like a killer. But when he set out in his green Ford truck that afternoon of February the 11th, 1937, he had killing on his mind, and rape. It was just after 3:30 when the children came out of high school. He passed several girls, but there were always people around, or other cars on the road. And then he saw, far ahead, a solitary female figure on a lonely stretch of road. Without hesitation, he swerved the truck and struck her, knocking her down. The youth jumped out, picked up the unconscious girl, and dumped her in the back. He drove to a deserted farmhouse and carried the girl inside, and there he stripped her and raped her. The schoolgirl seemed to be dead, or so the attacker later claimed. He carried the naked body to the well outside and threw her down it, and after that he went home and he ate a good dinner. 2 days later he returned to the farm with a stick of dynamite, which he threw down the well. The explosion partly covered the body with rubble. The police, who were confronted with the disappearance of 16-year-old Helen Moyer, were at first baffled. They found her shoes and her schoolbooks close to the spot where she'd been knocked down. The shoes had been split open, and the shattered glass of a headlight suggested that she had been the victim of a hit-and-run driver. But where was she? When the news of the girl's disappearance became known, two people contacted the police. One was a scrapyard worker, and it seemed possible that he had actually seen the accident from a distance. At least, he had seen a green truck swing across the road and hit a telegraph pole. It backed, turned, and hit another pole, and then it had driven off fast. Helen Moyer's next-door neighbour, a 15-year-old schoolgirl, also came forward. 6 days before Helen's disappearance, she had accepted a lift from a young man in a green truck. He had had a baby face and wore dirty overalls. He pulled up in a quiet lane and tried to undress her, but the girl fought back and he hit her with a wrench. She had managed to jump out of the truck and to run towards a house, and the man drove off. Police examined the telegraph poles and found flakes of green paint, the same type of paint that they had found on Helen's shoes. They began tracing and questioning the owner of every Ford truck in Chester County, and when the Philadelphia police discovered that 20-year-old Alexander Meyer was the owner of a green Ford truck, they realised suddenly that this might be their man. 3 years before, Meyer had been sentenced to an indeterminate sentence for firing at two Philadelphia girls with a rifle. He was the son of a well-to-do coal broker from Downington, 12 miles from the place where Helen had disappeared. The medical record from the reformatory said that he was a constitutional psychopathic inferior, the victim of his own retarded mentality, insensible to pain, sadistic, and slightly effeminate. Meyer was arrested as he was driving his milk truck, the Green Ford, and taken in for questioning. At first he denied all knowledge of the girl. Then, when the police pointed out that the dents in his truck corroborated the scrapman's story and that the paint matched that found on the schoolbooks, he admitted that he had knocked Helen down, but he said it was an accident. Finally, the whole true story of the attack and rape came out, and he led the police to the well. There, the body was dragged to the surface, minus a leg torn off by the blast. Medical evidence revealed that the girl had been alive when she was thrown in and that she had died by drowning. Meyer went to the electric chair in April 1937. More than half a century later, the baby-faced beast has still not been forgotten in Coatesville. The horror of the story drives us to ask, why do such things happen, and how can they be prevented? There's no simple answer to either question. Meyer was a pervert, like Jack the Ripper, like Peter Curtin and Harvey Glattman, who indulged in his sadistic fantasies by tying up his female victims and photographing them as they struggled, before finally choking them to death. In psychological terms, these men were suffering from obsessional neuroses. One idea dominated their minds to the exclusion of all others. Most of us have to make a considerable effort to concentrate on a particular subject for more than a fairly short period. We are distracted by things that happen all around us. A child may be watching television, but if somebody brings him a new toy, he will instantly forget the program to play with the new toy. An older child or a teenager might well finish watching the program and then examine the toy. It's decided to take one pleasure at a time. This is sensible, but not entirely desirable. For people who take life as it comes, and enjoy the pleasure of the moment spontaneously, are often healthier and happier than more sensible people. an obsessional sense of duty often produces ulcers. We all have to learn to balance our sense of purpose with the ability to just open up and enjoy the present moment. This is something that the obsessional cannot do. An obsessional is not necessarily a pervert. Some women are obsessed with cleanliness in the home. Many patients in mental homes wash their hands every time they touch something. Obsession is what happens when the sense of purpose gets wildly out of hand. But if the obsession happens to be sexual, then the community has reason for concern. Freud's explanation of the obsessional type was that it represented the outstripping of libidinal development by ego development, which simply means that a child's ego, his sense of his own importance, grows faster than his sense of pleasure. Libido doesn't only refer to our love energies, but to all kinds of enjoyment, from playing football to eating an ice cream. But Freud's definition only describes the obsessional. It doesn't explain him. One thing is clear, the pervert is essentially immature. All babies want their own way, and they see no reason why they shouldn't have everything that they want. If the family background involves a great deal of love and security, they soon begin to learn to give, and to give way. They recognise that having their own way in everything would give pain to those they love. So one basic answer to the problem of the obsessional is lack of love in childhood. Love has the same effect on the personality as sunlight does on vegetation. It causes it to grow and to ripen. Without love, the obsessional sees no need to ripen, to try to grow up. Perhaps his parents denied him many things he wanted in childhood, so he harbours a deep feeling of resentment. Later, he feels that society is denying him many things he wants, and so he's prepared to grab it when society is off his guard. The result is behaviour like that of Alexander Meyer, where another human being is treated purely as a dispensable object, like a throwaway handkerchief. In his book Sex Perversions and Sex Crimes, Dr. Melvin Reinhardt describes the temperament in two words, the remorseless ego. The characteristics are always the same, a completely self-enclosed state of mind in which the other person is unreal. Most child murderers, such as Ian Brady, belong to this type. In 1953, a middle-aged pervert named Carl Folk hijacked a trailer containing a man and wife, Raymond and Betty Allen. He tied up the husband, and then he spent a whole night raping and torturing the wife, who finally died. Folk was so preoccupied that he didn't notice the husband's escape, and he was startled when Raymond Allen pulled open the door and shot him in the stomach. But it was too late to save Betty Allen. When Raymond Allen shot him, Folk was about to drench the caravan with petrol to burn the Allens and their baby. He treated them as throwaways, whose sole purpose was to provide him with pleasure. Folk was sentenced to death. In a sense, such perverts are insane. They've allowed their obsession to dominate them until it becomes their sole aim. And yet to call them insane is to evade the central issue. There's undoubtedly an element of free will in all this. The pervert chooses to be insane. This can be seen in one of the grimmest cases of compulsion on record, the murder of Alice Porter by Donald Fearn near Pueblo in Colorado in 1942. Fearn was a 23-year-old railway mechanic, a mild-looking, bespectacled little married man. He was fascinated by the stories of the Pueblo Indians and their capacity to bear pain. In an adobe church out in the desert, members of an Indian sect called the Penitentes had tortured and sometimes crucified one another. Fearn began to spend a great deal of time in the adobe church, 50 miles outside Pueblo. He was particularly obsessed by the blood-stained altar. No doubt a writer of weird tales in the H.P. Lovecraft tradition might suggest that he was taken over by the spirits of the Penitentes. But the explanation is simpler. By brooding on thoughts of torture, he brought a flash of intensity into his otherwise dull life, and he dreamt of kidnapping a girl and taking her to the adobe church. "Ever since I was a young boy, I've wanted to torture a beautiful young girl." He put his fantasy into practice on April the 22nd, 1942, when his wife was in hospital having their second baby. 17-year-old Alice Porter, a pretty student nurse, was walking home from evening classes at 9:30 in the evening. Fearn jumped out of his car, pointed a gun at her, and ordered her to get in. She screamed, and a nearby resident looked out in time to see a blue car driving away. Fern drove Alice Porter to the Adobe Church and then proceeded to put his sadistic fantasies into practice. He bound her, undressed her, and then placed her on the altar and tortured her in a manner that has never been fully reported. It involved binding her with red-hot wires. Fortunately, she lost consciousness long before Fern had finished. Finally, he raped her, and, like Meyer, he threw her body down a well. Driving home through a storm, his car bogged down in the mud, and he had to find a local farmer to haul it out with his tractor. He then went back to Pueblo to visit his wife in hospital. The baby had been born the day before. When the police finally searched the Adobe church, the burnt remains of the girl's clothes and the torture kit convinced them that they had found the site of the murder. They soon located her body in the well, the head battered with a hammer. There were fingerprints on an awl, which had obviously been used in the killing, but they were not of any known sexual offender. Routine investigation led the police to the farmer who had hauled Fern's car out of the mud. He told them it was an old Ford sedan. The detectives eventually located it in a Pueblo garage. Fern's fingerprints matched those on the awl. When details of the murder came out, mobs gathered, and there was talk of a lynching. Fern was taken to jail in Cannon City for his own safety. On October the 22nd, 1942, he was executed in the gas chamber there. It's worth making one purely practical point about this case. If Alice Porter had screamed and run, it's possible that Fern might have shot her, but the chances are that he would not have killed her. Rape cases reveal this as a basic truth, that girls who refuse to allow themselves to be forced into cars escape without harm more often than girls who submit, hoping to get it all over quickly. As in the case of Alexandra Meyer, the girl who fights and tries to escape stands a good chance of survival. This is not invariably true, of course. A girl may escape more serious injury if she submits to her attacker. But in innumerable cases involving rapist killers, it is the girls who have fought who have lived to identify their attackers. It seems to be partly a question of victimology. The question, then, is not simply how to prevent people like Donald Fern from becoming possessed by sadistic obsessions, but also how to prevent girls like Alice Porter from making it too easy for them. It's true that cases like the ones described above produce a certain feeling of helplessness, that there is absolutely nothing that doctors or criminologists can do about perverts like Glattman, Meyer and Fern. But it would be a mistake to allow this feeling to paralyse our sense of balance and logic. To begin with, when we study such cases, we begin to see the emergence of an overall pattern. And to see a pattern is to begin to understand a thing scientifically. And that's the first and most difficult step in solving any problem. For example, we see that men like Harvey Glattman, Peter Curtin, Donald Fern are not exactly a modern phenomenon. Kraft Ebbing describes the girl stabber of Bozen, a case of 1829, a young soldier with violently sadistic impulses. He writes, "Gradually the thought came to him how pleasurable it would be to stab a young girl in the genitals, and to take delight in the sight of blood running down the knife." After several attacks on girls, he was arrested. In 1867, in Alton, in Hampshire, a clerk named Frederick Baker, a young man of great respectability, spoke to three small girls who were playing in a meadow, and he offered one of them, Fanny Adams, a halfpenny to go with him into a hollow. He led her away, crying. Late that evening, searchers found the child's head in a hop garden. Other parts of the body were scattered around the garden. After Baker's arrest, his diary was found and an entry that read, "Killed a young girl today. It was fine and hot." He was hanged in December 1867. In 1880, a four-year-old child named Louise Dreux vanished from her home near the Tuileries in Paris. The following day, neighbours reported to the police the foul black smoke that was issuing from the chimney of a retarded 20-year-old youth named Louis Menesclou, who lived on the top floor of the same house. The police burst in and searched Menesclou. They found the child's forearms in his pockets and parts of her body half-burned in the stove. He admitted luring the child to his room with sweets, where he had violated her and then killed her. In his pocket, the police found a poem by Menesclou that ended, "In my blind fury, I don't know what I'm doing." He admitted sleeping on the corpse on the previous night. He was executed. In Manhattan, in February 1961, a four-year-old girl named Edith Kikorius vanished from outside her home. The uncle, who had been keeping an eye on her, had gone off to buy cigarettes. There was a massive police search. Police finally looked into the recently vacated room of an alcoholic dishwasher, 34-year-old Fred Thompson, and they found the child's violated body hidden there. Thompson was caught in Toms River, New Jersey. He was an electronics expert, but he had been in and out of sanatoriums many times for alcoholism. These killers all have one thing in common. They're outcasts. Men living alone without real social contact. The American psychologist William Glasser has said that before he can start to cure a patient, the patient needs to have one real contact with another person. Without such a contact, there can be no cure. Thompson, Manescu, Baker, Fern, Meyer all lacked this contact. They were living in modern civilization like hermits in a desert. This is the foundation of the problem, Karl Marx's alienation. And this once again suggests immediate grounds for optimism. Marshall McLuhan, the communications expert who is the author of the bestseller Understanding Media, 1964, has pointed out that the various forms of alienation were the outcome of the invention of printing and other mechanical devices, like the wheel and the radio, that became extensions of man and produced a new environment. People felt cut off, like a child lost in an engineering factory. Television is again changing the world into a global village. It's bringing all kinds of people into other people's homes, and the smallness, the lack of definition in a TV picture, means that children scan it for meanings in the same way that an African tribesman might scan it. They don't follow it as a literate adult follows a cinema film or reads a novel. And so McLuhan believes that some of the basic effects of alienation will wear off. We shall again have a society of non-alienated people who communicate directly with one another. McLuhan may be over-optimistic, but his ideas suggest that these new mass media, TV, pop records and so on, might be used in some purposeful way to bring people closer together, to educate at a partly unconscious level. His most famous assertion, that the medium is the message, means that it doesn't matter whether television is showing gangsters shooting each other or Mickey Mouse. It's the medium itself, not what it says, that has the really important subliminal effect. If this is true, it suggests new and interesting approaches to the increasing problem of crime. It is admittedly difficult to see how a McLuhanized criminology could do anything about the real perverts, for example, about a man like the Hungarian Sylvester Matuszka, a company director who needed to see a train crash in order to achieve full sexual satisfaction and dynamited a number of trains in the early 1930s. On Saturday, September the 12th, 1931, as the Budapest-Vienna Express was crossing a viaduct near Torbodzs station, there was a tremendous explosion and part of the train plunged into the abyss. 22 people were killed. It had been detonated by an electrical device. One of the passengers who sued the railway company for injuries was Matuszka. But when the police began to investigate his background, they could find no one on the express who had actually seen him, although he had undoubtedly been at the scene of the explosion. Further investigation revealed that Matuszka had bought dynamite. He was arrested and finally confessed that the Bir Torbodzs explosion was his third attempt on a train. He had also been responsible for an unsuccessful attempt to derail the Vienna-Passau train near Ansbach on New Year's Day 1931, and for derailing the Vienna Express near Berlin on August the 8th, 1931, in which 16 people were injured. Matuszka was tried several times, the juries being unable to agree on his sanity. Matuszka explained that a spirit called Leo had ordered him to wreck the trains. He was finally sentenced to hang, but appeals led to the commutation of the sentence to life imprisonment. The crime writer Paul Tabori has reported that he was subsequently freed by the Russians and went to work for them as an explosives expert. It may ultimately be impossible, even for the most highly skilled social engineering, to eliminate madmen like Matuszka, but it could, undoubtedly, do a great deal to reduce the alienation level in our society. In so doing, it could not only reduce the number of sadistic perverts, but also have decisive effects in lowering the crime rate. This is an aim well worth the deepest consideration of all criminologists and social workers.